Nacho Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the 51st episode of the Calcio Land podcast. So I'm joined by our great producer, co-host Alex Goldberg. I have to make a confession to everyone. After that interview with Rory Smith, I had to take a little break because the research was humongous and I felt a lot of pressure for that interview, so I needed a little break. But I wanted to ask you, Alex, we got great feedback on that segment with Rory. We cannot thank him enough for joining us. What was your favorite part of all that?
Yeah, it was a great interview. He had a lot of good insight. And one of the things that he had really tremendous insight on, in my opinion, was Paulo Dybala. There's a lot of talk about Paulo Dybala everywhere because he's an emerging star. So you learn certain things about him, but I thought just him talking about the fact that nowadays it's very rare for a player to go, of course, he started in his home country in Argentina, second division, I believe he said, and then he goes to Palermo and then to Juventus. And it was just the point of that's not really done anymore. You have your Ousmane Dembele's, you have your Kylian Mbappe's already going to top teams. And what I really liked was him saying, well, I think Dybala is probably better off for this because he had to grow up a little bit quicker because he was the guy at Palermo. And then he's a little bit more ready to move to Juventus. So I thought that was a very astute point by Rory. I guess it just makes me think that, all right, if Dembele has a really good week when he comes back from an injury, or Mbappe is already doing really well at PSG, just be cautious that they could have some growing pains. Dembele's already had growing pains, let's be real. He had that at Borussia Dortmund. So it almost makes me more confident that Dybala's ascending to superstardom is here to stay. I thought that was a good point about how he went from Argentina to Palermo to Juve. So there was a lot of great things, but that's what stood out to me. David, I want to announce something that's a little exciting here. We're finally done with the international break. Thank God. I'm just not a big international break. We have a slate of fun, exciting games, especially in Serie A this weekend. So let's announce to our listeners now that we've had the terrific 1,000 names with his predictions ahead of the weekend, and we recap them. But now, David, you are going head-to-head predictions. So I like it. I feel like your chest is stuck out a little bit on this. I think it'll bring some more fun to see who did better. So without further ado, I want to introduce the game predictions starring David Amoyal as well.
So I'll tell you this, 1,000 names for at some point he was 5-1 2 weeks in a row, like really remarkable, was also almost nailing the scores exactly. His descriptions of the games were perfect. And I think his chest went up a little bit. The final week, then he went 0-3. So I saw blood in the water and I was like, you know what? I'm going to jump into this, but I'm going to caution everyone. I am notorious for being terrible at predicting games. When I started doing it, I noticed that I'm great at jinxing teams, so take it for what it's worth. So it's also an opportunity for me to talk trash with thousands via DM. That's why I wanted to do it as well. So without further ado, we're going to preview the three big matches. And there's a lot of people in Italy tuning in to hear what Thousand has to say. So as usual, I'm going to read them in English and Italian. My picks are going to be just in English. So let's start with the first big match on Saturday, 12 o'clock game here in the U.S., 6 o'clock in Turin. Lazio's traveling to Juve to face them in a big match. Lazio off to a great start to the season. So Fausen's prediction is Juve is going to win 2-0, goals by Dybala, Higuain. His take is the Juve's loss in the Super Cup is going to be avenged. And you guys know by now, Fausen believes in conspiracy theories. He thinks Lazio, he didn't say the fix is in, but Lazio's basically going to mail in this match. My prediction, I still have Juve winning. I have it though 3-1. I think Higuain, who didn't play for Argentina today, Allegri in the press conference, really pumped him up. He's going to score 2 goals. I think Dybala, who didn't play for Argentina, is going to score, but I think Ciro Immobile, who's on absolute fire, is going to get a goal for Lazio. So in Italian, this is what Fausen had. Juve Lazio 2-0, Dybala Higuain, vendicata la Supercoppa, la Lazio continua a scansarsi in campionato a Torino. Next match, the evening match in Serie A, to me, probably the biggest match, even more than the derby because of the standings. Roma Napoli, a lot of security concerns for this one. Napoli won't have any fans at the Olimpico. 1,000 has this as 1-1, goal by Dzeko and Callejon. I died laughing when he said this. Napoli is going to be distracted from all the celebration for the Scudetto. I had mentioned this last week with Napoli going into the international break at first place down there. They love celebrating early, so he thinks they're going to be distracted by all this. He also said that Roma's coach, Di Francesco, is more about luck than soul. My take, I had a hard time thinking about this, and you guys know that I'm kind of in the tank for Napoli. I've been known for underrating Roma, but I'm still going to pick Napoli. And the reason I say that, I have them winning 3-1. I think this is the time that Roma's defense is going to get really exposed. They supposedly are going to have Bruno Perez and Juan Jesus starting. Bruno Perez, pretty good pushing forward, a huge liability, though, defensively. Manolas is very good, but his partner, Juan Jesus, I can't say the same. So I think Napoli is going to take advantage of this. I think they're going to have goals by Mertens, Hamsik, and Callejon, with Dzeko getting one for Roma. So in Italian, Roma-Napoli 1-1, Dzeko Callejon, Napoli distratto dai festeggiamenti per lo scudetto vinto. I died laughing. Di Francesco più culo che anima, fidatevi. And the derby on Sunday, big game, Inter-Milan, 1,000 has it, 1-1. Goals by Perisic. He has Kalinic. I'm going to give him a break. He sent me this before we knew that Kalinic was out. I'm still going to go on the assumption that even though Kalinic isn't going to play, that he still has it as a draw. His comments are, this is the Croatia that we like. Both of them are Croatian. I think this is a shot at Mandzukic. And he said, this is the usual draw between two teams that are sick. Not sick as in great, but sick as in ill. I've been thinking a lot about this. We talked about it too later in the interview segment. Both of our guests agree that Inter is better, but in the derby, it's not always the best team that wins. I think Milan just cannot afford to not get a result. Should they lose, they'd be 10 points behind Inter. Their season would be in huge jeopardy. So I actually have Milan with an upset win here. I have goals by João Mário for Inter, and then I have Suso and André Silva scoring for Milan. So for those scoring at home, those are the picks. We're going to tally this. Let's see who does better between me and 1,000 moving forward. As always, we appreciate his contributions. And speaking of things that we appreciate are your Twitter questions. We're going to get through them quickly because we have two guests that I'll introduce right after. So let's start with the questions that we have for this week. Which ones are we going to go over, Alex?
All right, David, we got our first over-under. Over-under. 3 years until Milan reaches the Champions League quarterfinals.
So shout out to SlickRick6 who sent me this question. I made the mistake of writing a tweet on promotion and relegation in the United States, and I haven't been able to get off my notifications ever since. But he was a really cool guy, and he said he thought it as an argument. I didn't, but that he said he got into our podcast as a result of our discussion and loves it, so he wanted to send in a question. So this is a great question. You know, Milan has that great DNA in Europe. Even when they weren't particularly good, they always seemed to overachieve. But 3 years to get to the Champions League quarterfinals, to me, that's asking a little bit too much. Other than Juve, I can't almost remember the last time an Italian team made it to the quarterfinals. Might have been Napoli with Mazzarri. I could be totally wrong. So I'm going to take that it's going to be over this. I would like to be proven wrong. I just don't think it's a guarantee. If I have to say now, I don't even know if Milan will be back in the Champions League next season. Unless they win the Scudetto, they wouldn't be, you know, in the pots and the seeds, they wouldn't be particularly high. So I'm going to take the over on that, but I'd love to be proven wrong.
I think Vegas probably would agree with you. Okay. Why do the football pitches in Italy vary in quality, and why don't they have standards or regulations for that?
So the answer to this question is included in the question, and it's the word Italy, and I'm just going to leave it at that.
All right. I like that a lot. All right, David, who amongst the top six has the best depth aside from Juventus?
It's a great question. I'm going to say definitely Napoli. Their backup midfielders are just filthy good. You could have on the bench Diarra, Zielinski, Raj. I mean, that's just filthy. They're deep at center back. They have Maximovic and Tonelli. They brought Mario Rui as a backup left back. Even without Milik, I'm still going to pick them as the best depth outside from Juve. And I think an underrated one, not as good as Napoli, but Lazio, has quite a bit of talent. They've done a good job to be able to juggle both the Europa League and Serie A, in my opinion.
Okay. David, what is your favorite stadium in Italy?
It's a great question, Rory. The part that I love the most was the way he described the San Paolo, and he said nobody sits in the first ring because if not, you'd get hit in the head with something. That's the part that made me laugh the most. So I got to be honest, I haven't been to a ton of stadiums in Italy because I moved away from there a while ago, but I've been to a few. So, you know, I really like the stadium in Genova, Marassi Stadium. I haven't sat in the Curva. I heard that can be very rough, but in the other seats, it's quite nice. Of course, I've been at San Siro, who I think looks great on TV. Definitely need a makeover of the bathrooms and whatnot, but it's a great game experience to go there. I also really, I've been to quite a few times at the stadium in Verona, the Bentegodi, because it's close to my hometown, Padova. There, you know, the athletic ring around the pitch makes it a little bit hard to watch. Juventus Stadium is an absolute jewel, though. To me, that's a comparable stadium that you would see here in the U.S. It's really, really nice. This year, I'm going to go to the Olimpico in Rome for first time, so I'll be able to tell you. But my favorite is the first stadium I went to, and it's in my hometown of Padova, the Appiani Stadium. The team doesn't use it anymore, but that's where I got to see Del Piero play as a teenager and where I got to watch Di Livio, one of my favorite players growing up. So I hope to add to this list. So I would say Juventus Stadium is the jewel. Marassi, a great place to watch, but my heart is at the Appiani Stadium.
Okay, I like it. All right, David, what is your take on Andrea Pirlo retiring? What is your favorite memory of Pirlo?
So very quickly, I found it a little bit comical that everyone thought, you know, Pirlo was announcing his retirement. I mean, he just did an interview with someone that I know, the Gazzetta dello Sport correspondent in the U.S., Massimo Lopez Peña, great journalist. I want to have him on our pod. So to me, he hadn't really announced it. He had just confirmed something he had already said, that at the end of the MLS season, he was going back to Italy and he was done. So, you know, we'll discuss this more. I'm actually going to try really hard to see if we can get Pirlo on the pod. Discuss this with him. I'll tell you two stories on Pirlo. I actually met him in the locker room at New York City FC the first year that he was there. Funny story, like he came out of the shower with little to nothing on, and I told him, I was like, hey, I've been trying to meet you for a long time. Never figured I'd get to know so much of you the first time, and he thought that was hilarious. He's a very funny guy. And speaking of that, my favorite memory of Pirlo isn't so much on the pitch, although he's probably my favorite player from the past 20 years. The stories in his books on the pranks he used to do to Gattuso are absolutely hysterical, especially on the Italian national team. There's a story on Pirlo and De Rossi hiding in Gattuso's room at Italy's retreat. They hid there literally for hours waiting for him to fall asleep, and then they jumped on him and he freaked out. The description on it on the book is absolutely hilarious. So as much as I love Pirlo on the pitch, his sense of humor is maybe something that that a lot of people don't know of.
What a legend. Okay, last Twitter question. What do you think of Juve agreeing to make a docuseries on Netflix?
So I think it's great. And I have a feeling Juve's new social media manager who came from the U.S., Daniel Robertson, a great guy, used to work for some MLS teams. I've talked to him a few times. I have a feeling he had a lot to do with this. Here in the U.S., you know, we see these kind of documentaries. You know, there's Hard Knocks in the NFL with boxing before big fights. They've done them many times. So I think it's great that Juve is doing this. Netflix, you know, it's in Italy. It's all over the world. Juve is definitely trying to expand their brand internationally. So kudos to them. I think that's fantastic. So I want to thank everyone who sent in questions. So we wanted to preview the derby with two guests. First, we have my friend Yanis Mihailik from ESPN. Unfortunately, the connection on the phone wasn't great, so I apologize. Some parts of the audio are a little bit patchy, but he gave us some really great insight. I think you'll really enjoy that part. And then for the Inter perspective, We have, for the third time, our friend Andrew Barker from Variety Magazine join us. He gave some great insight into Inter. We also got into Tom Petty. So if you're not interested in that part, we saved it for the end. But I think you should check it out because there was some great stuff. So we want to thank all of you guys for your support. Please keep leaving reviews and retweeting us. We count on you to market the podcast. So today, with the Derby della Madonnina coming this weekend, we figured we'd have a guest to focus on Milan and a guest to focus on Inter. And we wanted to start chatting about Milan with my really good friend, Yannick Mihailik. You guys know him from ESPN. He also has a show on SiriusXM. You can hear him on the Yes Network, calling New York City's FC games pretty frequently. He's an astute observer of Serie A with a keen eye on Milan. So we are thrilled to have you join us for the second time on Calcioland, my friend.
David, always nice to be here. Yes, always near my heart, Serie A, Milan. Although I do pay attention to Napoli these days. Although, you know, Arek Milik, obviously unfortunate for him. And Poland, again, injured. Zieliński doesn't seem to be able to find himself a spot there. But maybe that's for another show. So anyway, I mean, you got to enjoy the way Napoli plays anyway.
Well, we're very pro-Napoli on this podcast, so we share your sentiments there. So the reason I wanted to have you on, in my heart, I know you as the Prime Minister of Common Sense, a nickname you got on a show we both used to do in another life. So with Milan, the way I see it, we've swung from the euphoria of a very busy and exciting summer transfer window to the massive letdown from the past two matches, the loss to Sampdoria and the home loss to Roma. So since you are known for having great common sense and not being taken by emotion too much, tell me where you think Milan is. Is there somewhere in the middle between the euphoria from the summer and the disappointment from the past 2 weeks?
Well, first and foremost, I think when we all saw the signings, we knew that this was a new era, new team, and totally different. The obvious answer and the logical one that, you know, I don't think you need me to say is that it takes time. As a former player, I kind of, you know, you first see this, you're looking for partnership, you're looking to develop these partnerships, the communication. So that is an obvious one. It was a different culture. However, saying that, David, I think there's certain culture and certain level that you shouldn't have to drop below. So I think at this stage, although I did not think that was going to be smooth sailing, I would have seen Milan maybe just a little bit higher. You know, losses are losses. Look, Roma are good enough to beat you, right? Regardless.
Yeah.
Sampdoria away, that's, you know, that's a little bit different. I think it's not a big issue. However, because of those two losses, this Milan derby takes on even a bigger meaning for them. And, you know, we'll see what happens. There is a certain amount of pressure. There should be pressure. Turning the team over shouldn't be an excuse to go for the season and say, well, you know, it's okay. We see signs and, you know, it's a 2 or 3 year project, because you know what? In today's world, nobody gets to do 2 or 3 year projects. You have to win now.
Absolutely. So you hinted to something I wanted to ask you next. As you mentioned, you're a former player. You have over 40 caps with the U.S. national team. You're also part of the junior Polish national team. So you know firsthand the working in a professional team environment. You mentioned all the new players. And, you know, with Milan, I understand for fans it's frustrating after all these years of disappointment when Berlusconi was in spending that it's a little bit hard to ask for more time. But the reality is with all these new players, you have to. So what's your take? If you have to give, is it even possible to give a timeline on when this will feel more like a team rather than a collection of new acquisitions?
Well, there are a couple of things that are very important. And one of the most important things is Montella situation. And there would always be speculation about Montella. Is he the one? And here's my take that I don't know, I always felt in the back of my mind. I wasn't super vocal about it. Maybe I wasn't asked what it was, but with this sort of project and how massive of a turnover, I would not have Montella from the beginning being a coach.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that, you know, I don't even mean it that he's not good enough for that. I just think that you have a manager that already started while being a Milan coach in a different mind frame, right? I mean, you know, young players, he didn't know what the new takeover was going to be, right? Nobody knew how that was going to take this long and all of that. So as a manager, I think if you release a bomb like this, I'm not sure if it's a good word, but you know what I mean, right? When you blow this
yeah.
thing up like this, and not just on the field, but in the boardroom as well, I think you probably needed to look for a personality that's not only used to that, that has experience, that's beyond reproach in a situation like this, right? And again, I want to make sure, you know, I mean, people can say, is he good enough or not, and this, that, or the other. But my gut feeling was that they should have gone in a different direction with a manager because it's such a big project. You're starting absolutely fresh for the most part, and I think they needed to. Now, having said that, I'm trying to think as I speak now, you know, was there a man ready for that? Who would have been? I don't know if I have the answer for that at that particular time. But I think this is going to hang over Montella a little bit because it's not going to take much. And as I said, it's not always going to be on him. We're already hearing these things right now. I was 100% sure that was going to be it.
Yeah, and the thing with Montella is, you know, with all the excitement from the summer transfer window, that put even more pressure on him. And he wasn't a hire from the new regime. He was a holdover from the other. So definitely
correct.
The clock is ticking on him. So speaking of Montella, you know, definitely the squad is much, you know, maybe not much deeper, but there's definitely more quality on the squad. There's been, you know, Montella has tried a couple of different formations. The good news for Milan is whichever formation he uses, you're going to have two, maybe three starting caliber players on the bench. So that tells me that the squad is definitely better. But if you were the coach of the team, what formation would you use?
Well, look, I mean, you do have to be flexible. I think it's best. I mean, we can go on and on and on. You're looking at this game. All indications are that he's going to go with three in the back, right? I don't necessarily think that it's bad, but against this Inter team, I would have gone with four. Look, Inter are a very good team. They haven't played maybe up to their potential just yet, right? Well, you and I were saying, don't sleep on this team because, Spalletti is a very good coach. It's exactly what they needed. And B, they have players, and you know, I've seen you tweet that, and I feel the same way. You know, a lot of United players. The worst thing that could have happened to United is they didn't get finished, right? And you probably see, I see you saying that the best thing for Inter is that they kept him, and I agree. This is a wide game. The reason that Inter maybe have not been the best, the Serie A is kind of, you know, when you play three or four or five weaker team, which is exactly what Inter played, I think in Serie A, you take the foot of the pedal a little bit more. I don't necessarily know why that is. But it happens to a lot of teams for the most part. Even if they're winning, you just see, I think the tempo itself gives you an opportunity to maybe know that eventually you're going to solve the team. But this is the derby. And I think that with, you know, from the fullbacks, you know, I don't know who's going to play on the left, D'Albero, Nagatomo, probably Nagatomo because he's more experienced. And then you have Perisic and Candreva, who we know are very good in getting to the byline, right?
Yeah.
I don't necessarily think that they're the fastest. I don't think, you know, they're different between the two. But Candreva, to me, amazing part about Candreva is I don't think he's necessarily great in one-on-ones. I don't think he's necessarily very fast. But I tell you what, there are not many that know how to arrive to that byline, you know, to pass players and get the ball across, right? So
absolutely.
I would have played with four here if you're Milan. I would have played Abate for his experience. I think that's super important. Keep Rodriguez in the back. Bonucci, you know, I'm not 100% sure if it's Bonucci or Romagnoli or Musacchios. Like, you know what I mean? I don't have a great feeling for who the partner in that four would have been, really. I think it truly does. I could be wrong here. It's just a problem with, you know, he seems to like Barini. Okay. My biggest problem in this lineup is Biglia. I hope he plays very deep and not aside of Cassie, right? I think he needs to be the one sitting in the back, because I think you have to allow Cassie to be kind of the box-to-box player, right? When I see him being asked to sit in the back next to Biglia or anybody else, I'm not so sure if that's the best use of his talents. That's just for me. Bonaventura is a big question. You know, people are probably going to call me crazy, but, you know, as I was thinking about it, when I was looking at this, I don't know if I'd be brave enough, and I certainly know that Montella is not going to be, but I almost don't know if I wouldn't go 4-3-3 in this one. Because the biggest question mark, and you help me because you watch this too, is Bonaventura. I think of him as a very, very good player, and I wouldn't be against playing him in the front three, actually, out wide, and allow him to come inside as well. You know what I mean? I think for this game, it's very good that Kalinic is not available. He isn't, right? I think it looks like he's going to be...
Yeah, he's going to be out,
He's going to be injured, because I think you're going to need the quickness. I think against Inter, it's good to have Suso and Silva kind of interchange a little bit and a little bit quicker team, because I think if this game has a slow tempo, especially on the Milan side, I think they're going to be in trouble. I think this can be your normal... maybe Serie A team where tactics overtake things. We all know that the tempo, I think for me in Serie A, is not very fast because there's a lot of fouls. It's sometimes very hard to find rhythm in the game. And Milan's been struggling with that as of late for me. I think this team's got to move quicker with and without the ball. So Suso and Andre Silva, it's actually not a bad thing, because I think if Kalinic was available, I think he starts. Not saying he would do badly, but that would have been a question mark for me.
It's interesting you mentioned. Go ahead.
No. That's you know me.
So you know, it's interesting you mention Bonaventura and Suso, because of all the new players, you know, they also need to get more of some of. They were arguably two best players on the squad last season. They need to get more out of them. And you mentioned Bonucci, who of course was the sexiest signing of the summer. I think even the most staunch Milan supporter would have to admit more was to be expected from him so far. So I wanted to get your take on him. You know, Juve has missed him too, because they have given up, for their standards, a lot of goals this season. So from your perspective, do you think Bonucci misses Chiellini and Barzagli more than maybe Juve misses him? But in general, what's your take on his performances?
Absolutely. Yes to both. And you know, that's why stability is such an important thing in the back, right? Knowing exactly what you're going to do, what the partner next to you is going to do, what are your partner's strengths and weaknesses, right? Because, you know, if you look at Juve, because we have to talk about the back three, but also Buffon, right? The back four. I mean, you can't forget what Buffon brings before he even makes a say, right, in terms of that. I can attest to that, right? So presence is super important now from the back in that communication. But, you know, because if you look at Bonucci, if you look at Juve when Bonucci was there, if you take all those players individually, right, we've had these conversations. Yeah. I don't think they're extremely special. I mean, how many times have we talked about Chiellini losing concentration, making simple mistakes, being too eager, you know, making mistakes or maybe giving away passes? All that, and we've seen that from Bonucci, but Bonucci was a little bit different because Bonucci is a little bit of a playmaker out of the back, right?
Yeah,
but in order to do that at Juventus, he knew that for the most part, that couple players that were happy to allow him to do that, they were happy to stay home. And I don't want to say do the dirty work, because that wasn't the case, because Bonucci would do his job as well. But we know about his distribution, we know how he likes to play these diagonal balls, longer balls, how he wants to move into the midfield.
Absolutely.
Has he underperformed? Maybe, but look, you know, he's got a new player in Musacchio. Romagnoli is still very, very young. Zapata's been playing. I mean, from game to game, I mean, could you name the starting three or four for Milan? No, you can't. There is no stability yet. So I think
very, very interesting. So you gave us some great analysis on Milan, so I have to end it on this and put you on the spot. You and I have been pretty high on Inter going into the season, but sometimes in the derby, it's not necessarily the best team that wins. So I wanted to take your take if you had to predict on the result for Sunday. What's your take?
As I said, if, you know, and I'll be able to tell, I think this is one of those games that you'll be able to say the outcome of the game. Going to be a winner, right? Because we've seen there's been draws the last couple of times. It's possible, right? But if Milan plays quickly and tries to attack early on, right, I think they'll win the game. There is a certain amount of bias. This is a very good Inter team. I've never liked them because of the rivalry, but I can appreciate the players and the way they play. I also appreciate Spalletti, as I've mentioned as well. So yeah. I look at Inter and I have to ask myself a question. You know, is it just Milan against Inter and I'm going to dismiss the opposition, right? Which I never would do anyway, you know, by now. It's my job to be unbiased. But I got to look at this team and says, I like this team. I worry about this team. They do have Icardi who scores at any given moment these days, right? I think on paper right now, Inter are favorites, and they should be. But it's an early must-win game for Milan because, look, maybe the points, maybe they can make them up sometime in the future. Who knows? But psychologically, after the Roma game, and if this was a loss here, I think you're starting to have all these problems. Montella's job is even more in a problem. We're going to start hearing more and more about Ancelotti, everything else. But forget that. You know, you're losing contact with top four, and there's other teams, right? I mean, big teams are playing against each other this weekend. So this is an opportunity for Milan to get back in touch with the top team. So I'm still going to go with Milan. Sorry.
Fantastic, Yanis. I want to thank you so much for joining us. It's always such a pleasure to chat with you and get your great insights. So thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, David.
Okay, so for the other side of the derby, I am joined by one of my favorite guests because when he's on, you know, we're going to get into some pop culture, which is my passion. So my good friend Andrew Barker is here. He's a senior features writer for Variety. This is his third appearance on the podcast. So today we're going to start talking about his favorite team, Inter, and then we're going to get into Tom Petty. If you're not interested in that part, you know, once you hear the word Tom Petty, feel free to drop off. But I think you guys will enjoy that part of the interview as well. So, Andrew, you know, I'm always thrilled to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for being on Calcio Land with us today.
Anytime. It's my pleasure.
Awesome. Okay. So the derby is coming, and when the first time you were on the podcast, you told me that you've been following Inter since the late 90s when the real Ronaldo, the Brazilian one, was on Inter. So when you think of the derby against Milan, what is one of the first memories that comes to mind for you?
You know, there's a lot, honestly. I mean, this is always my favorite, you know, two matches of the year. Mostly because I feel like, you know, for the years after Calciopoli, the derby with Juve always kind of, I mean, there was just so much bad blood on both sides. It was just kind of this nasty, like, sectarian conflict, you know. I mean, there was, like, passion there, but it was never fun to watch. Whereas the Madonnina was always a blast, you know. I mean, there's a lot of them. There's, you know, Palacio winning with that back heel goal a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Pretty bad match, but ended really well. I think back in the mid-2000s, there was a 4-3 victory that was just absolutely nuts. Remember Materazzi scored the winning goal and then immediately got sent off, which is like, you know, Materazzi in a nutshell, you know, to be the hero and the villain in like 120 seconds. But honestly, I mean, like the number one, you know, I'd be lying if I said it was anything other than the 4-0 victory in the treble season. Because obviously anytime Inter beats Milan 4-0, it's going to be a great match. But the context here was like, it was the second match of the season. And there's actually like a lot of uncertainty around the team at the time because the first match was with Bari. It was this kind of lame draw. And there's a bunch of new guys on the team. Ibrahimovic was gone. There was this whole ordeal with Wesley Sneijder where it just took weeks to sign him. And I think he signed like within a few days before the match. He probably had like one or two training sessions and they threw him right in. And it was just like the team just clicked immediately right there. And that was sort of where you knew that this team might have something special going on. Like I think of the, and I didn't know this at the time, but the second goal of the four was a Diego Milito penalty. And Samuel Eto'o had won the penalty. And once again, I didn't know this at the time, but Eto'o had this kind of bizarre clause in his contract that literally said specifically that he had first dibs on any penalty that Inter won while he was playing, which is crazy. But so Eto'o won the penalty, and he literally had it in his contract that he could take the penalty. But instead, he gave it to Milito so that Milito could score his first Inter goal. So it was just that kind of like selflessness that was kind of evident in the air. And I mean, I've gone back and watched that entire match like on YouTube more times than I'd like to admit.
Fantastic. So that's a great stroll down memory lane. So tell me a little bit about how confident you are with this Inter. You won 6 out of 7 matches. Maybe it hasn't been particularly pretty. Milan is struggling right now. So how confident are you going into this match?
You know, I should be more confident. I mean, like if the last time I was on this show, you told me that after 7 matches, we'd be 6-1-0, you know, level on points with Juve and best defensive record in the league, like I would have been overjoyed, but I'm an Inter fan. So all I can see is how badly we're setting ourselves up to blow it here. And I also, I mean, like you mentioned that Inter haven't been playing particularly well recently, but we've still been getting 3 points out of most of these matches. So that almost gives you like an excess of confidence, which can be dangerous. Whereas Milan, they've got probably like a nervous energy going into this match. You know, I mean, it's like if Inter loses, no one's going to say that Spalletti's job is in danger. But if Milan lose, then they might definitely say that about Montella, which is, I think, probably going to inform the way they come out. So I'm actually not that confident at all.
I kind of share your sentiment there. So you mentioned, you know, Inter's won some games. Maybe they didn't totally deserve it. So there's a lot of parallels to 2 years ago. Mancini's team got off to a similar start. When the first time you were on the podcast, you described being an Inter fan as being like the dude in the Big Lebowski driving around in his car, listening to Creedence with the Roach. Everything's fantastic. And then it all falls apart. So compared to that Mancini team, how do you feel about Inter moving forward and where they'll end the season?
I think that we're looking better than we did during the Mancini years, because I mean they were some awful performances that year, and yet we were still just like miraculously stayed in number one for an undeservedly long time. I mean I think there's definitely parallels though. Like we looked very good against Fiorentina in the first match, we looked great against Roma in the second, and then the performances have just kind of been getting like shaggier and shaggier steadily as we go, even if the results are still good. So there's definitely worrisome elements there. And, you know, I think it's that Spalletti, as good as the team is set up in a number of ways, he hasn't cracked the midfield at all. It's really not even his fault. It's just kind of this, like, I think all 5 of our midfielders are at worst, like quality players. And yet they all have these kind of very specific weaknesses and very specific sort of personalities where I don't know how you balance them against each other. You know, it's like if you, like, you're putting together an IKEA desk and you've lost the instruction manual, you know, like it's like you've got all the pieces there and it seems like straightforward, but you put it together and then like you notice like, oh, shit, the legs are on backwards. So you have to like take it apart and put it together again. And like you're like, wait, I got these 2 screws like in excess. What did I do wrong here? All right. Try, you know, like so he's like he's trying every possible combination. It's just never quite working.
So let me ask you this. You mentioned last time you were on, had I told you you're going to win 6 of 7, you'll be tied with Juve, you would have taken it. So in the spirit of that, if I offered you now that at the end of the season, Inter's going to finish 3rd, guaranteed spot in the Champions League, would you settle for that? Or based on what you saw, considering too they also have no European competition, do you think there's a chance they could be a Scudetto spoiler and keep up with Juve and Napoli?
I would take 3rd place. I wish I could say we're a contender, but I mean, I think this is the first time in a long time that we would actually deserve a 3rd place finish with just the quality of players and our coaching. But Napoli and Juve are just objectively better teams in almost every way. So no, I don't think we're going to be a contender. And you know, and I know you're a big like Sarri file, and I am too. Yeah, I'm absolutely 100% pulling for a Napoli Scudetto this year. Both because, I mean, I just die inside a little more every time Juve wins the title. But also just Napoli deserve it. I mean, they're probably the most aesthetically beautiful team in Europe right now. They have a fan base that's incredible. The city's incredible. I'm 100% rooting for Napoli in every match but two this year.
I share your sentiments completely there. Okay, so let's segue to it's going to be my favorite part of the podcast. So let's talk a little bit about Tom Petty, who unfortunately passed away last week. I think that was pretty unexpected, maybe not as shocking as Chris Cornell, which we had you on to talk a while back. So what I liked is you tweeted about Tom Petty that he was the rare classic rocker who was relevant when you were a kid. I think you mentioned you bought his record Into the Great Wide Open the same time as Nevermind, I believe. So tell me a little bit how you got into his music, and what was your take when you heard he had passed away?
You know, just first off, I wanted to say as a like personal disclaimer that I spent my early childhood in Arkansas and Texas. And we moved to Southern California, and I kind of like consciously made LA my hometown. And then Tom Petty, you know, was also a Southerner who moved to LA and made it his hometown. So there's probably like maybe some sort of, you know, unconscious mystical connection I felt with him, maybe. But yeah, like Petty has just always been a presence as long as I've been listening to the radio. And he was, like, my parents got me into a lot of classic rock just through their record collection, you know, Beatles and Dylan and Hendrix and Elton John. But Tom Petty was like part of that first wave of bands you discover when you really start listening to music for yourself. And that's because, like, unlike all those other guys, like I said, he, you know, when I was listening to the radio, there were, you know, there's new songs by Nirvana and Pearl Jam and REM and Metallica and Tom Petty, you know, and it's still in the mix, you know. I mean, I think, I don't know, it probably took me a long time to realize that Tom Petty's actually my dad's age, you know. Like, I mean, we think about like American Girl, you know, that came out in 77, and Mary Jane's Last Dance came out in like 1994, I think. And those songs sound like they were recorded, you know, 2 or 3 years apart. They're like giant hits, but for two completely different generations. But it's still that same sound and that same quality of songwriting. I mean, I think that's incredibly rare thing to see.
I have a very similar experience in how I got into it. Like, I saw the video for Into the Great Wide Open, and I was in, and then I did some research, and I didn't realize he had been around for that long. So ultimately, you know, he has a ton of hits. He was inarguably maybe the biggest super group as far as name goes in the Traveling Wilburys with Dylan, George Harrison, Orbison. So how do you think ultimately he gets remembered?
You know, since we're talking about Twitter, there was someone on Twitter, some music critic, I can't remember his name, should have looked it up. But he said after Petty died that he never thought of Tom Petty dying because Tom Petty seemed like a public utility, you know, like someone reliable who was always going to be there. And I think that's pretty accurate. And, you know, you always kind of go back through the discography when someone dies. But I think with Tom Petty, it was particularly impressive because, I mean, everyone loves Tom Petty. Like, if you don't love Tom Petty, there's something broken inside of you. But you have to really step back to appreciate the breadth of his catalog. And that's where, like, his legacy. I mean, I thought immediately about a couple of years ago, Sam Smith had this thing, and it was actually kind of embarrassing because this was like right before the Grammys, where Sam Smith won every award, where he had to go back to his biggest song and add Tom Petty's name to the songwriters, because the song was so close to Won't Back Down. And I remember thinking, because, you know, I knew the Sam Smith song, and I was like, that's got to be kind of nonsense. It can't be that close. And I listened to them together, and they are exactly the same song. and it's almost like, you know, that song and, like, a lot of Tom Petty songs are just, those melodies feel like they've just always existed. You know, it's like Johnny B. Good or Hey Jude. You know, they're just so deep in your psyche and in the culture that you almost don't think of someone like sitting down to write them. But he did sit down to write them, and he has a whole bunch of songs like that. You know, I mean, I think it's like the only thing that Sam Smith and the Strokes have in common is the fact that both of their biggest songs are basically Tom Petty ripoffs.
Absolutely. You know, like, I was just going to say that because Last Night is exactly like American Girl. Like, you barely tell them apart.
I don't know how they got away with that, man. It's crazy. So.
Yeah, I think the once the Strokes at a concert, they acknowledged it. I think they even threw in the lyrics from American Girl. So at least they didn't. So interestingly, I love the part that you said, you know, just like you, he came from the South, met L.A. his home. You know, he had the house in Malibu where he did all his records. And, you know, you mentioned that, you know, he's to the West Coast what Bruce Springsteen is to the East Coast. And the way I see it, too, you know, I've lived in Boston here in the U.S. I grew up in Italy. I'm a big city guy, but I did spend 1 year in Indiana. And when I think of Tom Petty, I think of like the goodness of the rural areas of the United States. Maybe right now with what we have in the White House and what got him there, it's easy to look down on that part of the country. But I always felt like Tom Petty showed a lot of the great sides of the rural area. But you looked on him more as a West Coast type of guy. And, you know, I definitely see the comparison to Springsteen. And the other two things that they have in common to me is they have amazing backing bands, like the E Street Band, of course, very, very famous on their own. But I find the musicians on Petty's band at least equal. His lead guitar player, Mike Campbell, is fantastic. His last drummer, Steve Ferrone, Petty used to always say he's my favorite musician. And their keyboard player, I think Rolling Stone, I read recently, said is the finest in American rock, which, you know, may be true or not true. But I've always found that band tremendous. So what's your take on his side musicians? And if you had to compare them with the E Street Band and could have just one band, which one would you take?
I mean, I'm biased because I'm a Petty guy more than a Springsteen guy. But I mean, like you said, like Mike Campbell's one of the most underrated guitar players in rock, and I think a lot of it's because he played so subtly on the records. I mean, if you've seen him live, you know that he can really stretch out in pretty amazing ways. But he had taste and restraint, and I mean, you can and also his guitar tone. Like, I don't know, like if you spend much time hanging around electric lead guitar players, they spend basically as much time messing with their tone as they do actually practicing. So to have a tone that's just that rich and solid is something. I know Jimmy Iovine at one point said that the Heartbreakers rhythm section was the best he'd ever worked with. And, you know, he worked with them immediately after Engineering Born to Run. So make of that what you will. I mean, you know, I've had personal conversations with Jimmy Iovine, and he says a lot of things, but still, but, you know, he did say that. But, you know, I mean, yeah, Springsteen, Petty, you know, it's interesting you mentioned kind of the heartland thing versus L.A. Petty would always, in interviews when people would refer to them as a Southern rock band, he would literally stop the interviewer and say, no, the Heartbreakers are an L.A. band.
Interesting.
And, yeah, and I think that's a big part of it. And I think a lot of it is kind of the same way that Springsteen, you know, I mean, Springsteen grew up, like, I don't know, an hour's drive from Manhattan, but he inhabited this world, this very gritty, downtrodden New Jersey world completely. And I think Petty is similar in the sense that, you know, he was an L.A. guy for the majority of his life, but he wrote about the San Fernando Valley mostly. You know, before he lived in Malibu, he was in Encino. And the Valley is very much the Jersey of L.A. You know, like Encino and Reseda, Canoga Park, there are all these, like, very unglamorous little areas that are really just as much a part of the city as Hollywood and Beverly Hills. Just no one ever really writes about him. So that's something that, you know, the same way Springsteen defines Jersey, I think Petty owns the blue-collar parts of L.A., you know, and he really gets the city just about as well as anyone has, you know, the way that it's, you know, it's one of the most beautiful big cities really in the world when it wants to be, but most of the time it's not because there's smog, there's congestion, you know, it's this very laid-back kind of casual place, you know, there's beaches and everyone smokes weed, but it's also like where every hard-boiled detective novel takes place and every noir movie, you know, there's this rot to it, you know, there's pretty people and then there's like vampires on Ventura Boulevard, you know, and I think he just loves the city but understands that essential disconnect as well as any songwriter I can think of.
Very interesting. So I want to ask you quickly, like, to me, Tom Petty, I've always found his songs, you know, incredibly visual. I'm certainly discovering the fact that he always told stories so well. You know, my first experience with him was the video for Into the Great Wide Open. I'd like to think that if I had just heard the song, I would have pictured it exactly like that video, which features Johnny Depp before he completely blew up. But tell me, which one of his videos is your favorite?
You know, I think on the one hand, Don't Come Around Here No More is obviously the iconic one. You know, that's the one people go to. But for me, I go with Free Fallin'. Both, I mean, to continue with the LA thing, it also has a lot of LA locations that you don't usually see on TV. I mean, I think it's mostly Sherman Oaks, which once again, in the Valley, not the nicest place. And, you know, I think it's amazing too, because that video should be kind of lame, both then and now, because it, you know, it's this probably 40-something old rock star, and he's got all these teenagers, and they're out there skateboarding, like he's trying to be down with what's cool in 1989, you know, trying to make this, like, Bones Brigade video. But it isn't lame at all. I mean, it feels completely genuine, and it enhances the song in a way that so many modern videos these days, I think, can't, you know. So I'd have to go with Free Fallin'.
Awesome. Okay, so let's close with this. So Tom Petty has had so many hits. As you said, he's like a staple of rock radio. You know, in his last tour, he basically was playing greatest hits, and, you know, 15, 18 songs, pretty much all of them are incredibly well known. But he's got a very deep catalog, and to get ready for this, I've been listening to a bunch of his records. You know, I know I have a feeling you love Wildflowers as well, which is the one he did with Rick Rubin when he was getting divorced. Yeah. Some great, you know, deep cuts there. So tell our listeners who might not be too familiar with his catalogs, maybe two or three songs that aren't the hits that you would recommend.
Well, if you want to start with Wildflowers, I think It's Only a Broken Heart is an incredible song. I mean, that's like the best George Harrison song that George Harrison never wrote. You know, obviously he toured with him, you know, in the Traveling Wilburys.
Yeah.
He really gets that Beatles sound without being derivative of it. Earlier on, there's the song Night Watchman, which I've always loved.
Yeah.
It's kind of a throwaway song, but it has this groove that's like the Ohio Players doing China Cat Sunflower by the Grateful Dead or something. It's this really unique kind of vibe. I mean, I think that's kind of the predecessor to Mr. Brownstone by Guns N' Roses, and you really listen to it. I'm sure Izzy Stradlin owned that album. And I got to shout out Walls. I mean, that's not really an obscure song. That's kind of entered the culture, I think, a little bit. But, you know, it wasn't on an album proper, and it was probably like his last really great song. But I think that song is just a gem. And I'd forgotten, actually, you know, Glenn Campbell, who died earlier this year, actually did a great cover of Walls. And he too was a Southern boy, moved to L.A. at a young age, from Arkansas, actually, like me. So, I guess me and Glenn Campbell and Tom Petty, man, we're paisans somehow.
Awesome. So, Andrew, what do you have going on at Variety? Anything you've been doing recently that we should check out? What are you working on right now?
I just got back from the Toronto Film Festival, saw some interesting stuff, although it's always kind of weird because usually the best things I see there don't come out for another 1 or 2 years, but I will definitely flag those when they do. And then just there's a million movies to see, so this is the fun time to be in entertainment journalism, even though the entire industry appears to be collapsing around us at the same time.
Fantastic. So I promise to have you on to preview Oscar season and the time of year that they make the movies for me instead of calling you next time there's a Deaf and Rock. And I want to thank you so much for joining us. As always, I love having you on. So thank you so much, Andrew.
Happy to be here, man. Thanks for having me.